Don't miss the biggest Maytag sale of the year at Lowe's. You'll find the Maytag appliances you need when you need them at a great price. Plus, when you buy two select laundry appliances, you'll get up to a $100 bonus via instant rebate. Shop Maytag at Lowe's. We help, you save. Offer valid through 531. See store for pricing and offer details. Advertise savings on all major Maytag appliances through Maytag.com and participating retailers. Prices may vary. Additional terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Steph.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Today.
And we're live.
Hello.
From New York State.
Oh, we're in New York, baby.
That is true. How are you?
We're recording from my childhood bedroom.
Yes, that is true. So if it does echo, don't worry about it.
Yeah, and also this is not our normal setup and we have to hold our microphones today. So if you hear any weird bumping sounds, no, you didn't.
We're victims.
This is really hard for us right now.
And I've been trying to say that for years.
No, we're happy to be here. And I am excited to tell you the story I have for you today because it's weird.
Okay, for you to say that, I feel like takes a lot.
Okay, say more. What do you mean?
I don't often hear weird. I hear...
Crazy.
Crazy.
Insane.
Insane.
Yeah.
Over the top. This is
synonyms.
So dark. Not weird.
Well, this is about a flood of molasses.
Okay, that's weird.
Weird.
Can you first tell me what molasses is? Because I'm thinking maple syrup, but I think I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's not maple syrup. Molasses is a thick, dark syrup that's a byproduct of the sugar refining process. It's made by crushing sugarcane or sugar beets to extract the juice, and then you boil the juice to form sugar crystals, and then you remove those crystals to leave behind light molasses, and then you can boil that down again to give it its signature brown, thick appearance. So it's basically just boiled down sugar.
Okay. Sweet.
Yeah, I guess.
I love when you have answers, like detailed answers for me that I don't have to work for at all. It's my favorite.
You're welcome. I was going to ask you how you felt about molasses, but I guess my answer is that you don't feel anything toward molasses because you've never had it.
I felt confusion.
That's fair. I've never had molasses either, but it's used in like baking and whatever. It was big back in the day, I believe.
Sure. I think it was cheap sugar to use back, you know, I don't know when, in like the 60s?
Sure. That makes sense.
Earlier? Yeah.
Yeah, earlier too. In 1914, the demand for molasses was at an all-time high. Molasses, just a fun fact, is 40% denser than water, so it's very thick. Not only was molasses used as a sweetener, since it was much less expensive than granulated white sugar, but molasses can be further refined into ethanol, the active ingredient in alcohol beverages, and a key component in munitions. So they were using it to make rum and industrial alcohol, which is a lot different. Industrial alcohol is not something that you can drink. If you do, you would probably die or go blind. But it was used to make explosives like dynamite and smokeless powder.
They put alcohol in dynamite?
Yeah, ethanol.
Bro, okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they needed a lot of alcohol to make it, and explosives were in very high demand because of World War I. It took 1 liter of alcohol to manufacture every pound of smokeless powder, and allies went through millions of pounds of explosives during World War I. So a lot of molasses was needed.
I mean, it's just so nuts that part of dynamite is a sugar beet.
Yeah, I never would have thought molasses was used in bomb making. That's
like
last thing I would have thought.
Right. They're like, oh, why are you growing these beets?
Yeah.
It's the bomb farm.
Yeah,
bomb farm.
I would think like, oh, this is for grandma's cooking, not like, oh, this is going to be an explosive device or
right.
something.
Or it's for a nice salad.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's different beets. Different
Whatever.
Kind of beets.
It's a beet.
Okay. So they were making bombs and people were stocking... You like that. And people were stocking up on rum, which they were also making because prohibition was set into effect in 1920, or it was about to be set into effect. So they were trying to make as much as possible, and people were stocking up as much as they could. The United States Industrial Alcohol Company produced and distilled molasses using a subsidiary called the Purity Distilling Company of Boston, Massachusetts. And there, they stored millions of gallons of molasses that was kept in this massive tank at 529 Commercial Street near Keeney Square. I hope that's how you pronounce that.
Keeney.
In 1915, the Purity Distilling Company rushed construction of this storage tank in the north end of Boston since molasses was in such high demand. The construction was to be overseen by Arthur P. Jett, their financial advisor. And Arthur Jett had no architectural or technical experience and was even unable to properly read the plans and blueprints. What could possibly go wrong?
A building collapse?
Or something. He also had no experience with safety factors and hadn't planned or even asked about any of it.
Oh.
Yeah. So by the time he had locked down the location of their tank, they had only 2 months to complete the project before their very first, very large shipment of molasses that would arrive. The tank was 50 feet tall, 90 feet across, and was capable of holding 2.5 million gallons of molasses, making it one of the largest storage containers in the city of Boston.
That number means nothing. Like, what? How big?
Big.
How big?
Like a building size.
Like a mile long?
50 feet tall, 90 feet across. It's like
that holds 2.5 million?
Yes. It's a very big cylinder.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
The tank's construction used large curved steel plates, 7 vertical rows overlapping horizontally, that were held together with rivets set onto a concrete base. Its construction cost the U.S. industrial alcohol $30,000. Imagine.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
The tank was located just 200 feet from the harbor and located near the railroad tracks, making it convenient for Purity Distilling to offload molasses from the ships that delivered it from Cuba until it was ready to be delivered by train to the refinery in East Cambridge. Not only had Jett not known any of the most essential things you would need to in order to construct something like that safely, but he had also cut corners as well, because why not? When the tank was finished in 1915, it wasn't even properly tested because the first shipment of molasses had come too soon. They were planning on filling it up with water to make sure it was structurally sound, but instead they only put 6 inches of water into the tank and then they declared it safe.
Wow, okay. I mean, it's 50 feet, guys. You barely even filled it up, like what, 1%?
Yeah, 6 inches instead of 50 feet of water, yeah.
All right.
And since the tank was just a container and not a building, there were no building permits or inspectors that were needed. They weren't even required in 1915. So the tank was just this looming presence over the businesses on Commercial Street and the nearby immigrant, Italian, and Irish neighborhoods. From the very beginning, this tank had issues. It would groan as it was filled, which people heard, including the man who was responsible for building it, and that was just ignored. And they also, after a little bit, started seeing that it was leaking molasses down the sides of the tank onto the street below or down the sides of the walls. So local residents would collect leaked molasses for their homes, and the children really liked that there was molasses on this tank because they could collect the syrup from the leaking rivets and like eat it as a little treat.
Wait, so is this tank out in public?
Yes.
Like for people to just look at?
Yeah,
I
it's there.
I thought it was like in a building.
No, it's just like on the street, like on the sidewalk. Just a big tank.
You don't think people are going to mess with it? In any capacity?
They weren't messing with it. They were just collecting the leaking molasses.
I mean, why not?
And
free sugar.
It had to be where it was because it was right by the water where the ships were coming in to bring the molasses to put it in the tank. And then it was by the train as well so they could ship it off to do whatever the hell they were doing with it. So it was like, yeah, it was just on the street.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think something that cost you so much and is so vital to your business.
And the war. Yeah.
You might have protected a little bit.
They weren't that concerned, clearly, because they didn't test anything about it. And they also put a man in charge who didn't have any like engineering experience. He didn't even know how to read blueprints.
Yeah. Well, here we are.
Right. So the children are essentially licking the sides of the container because the molasses is dripping down. And at least one employee...
It's so gross.
Nasty. So nasty. At least one employee warned that the tank was not structurally sound, but the United States Industrial Alcohol Company did very little about the issues. The most that was done was a little bit of caulking in the areas that leaked, and they went as far as to just repaint the entire tank brown in an attempt to hide the fact that brown molasses was leaking out of the sides. So they're like, we're not going to fix the leak. We're just going to paint it brown so you can't see it.
So this sounds to me as if it's a literal Band-Aid that they put on the tank.
Yes. Like not even a Band-Aid, less than a Band-Aid.
Right.
It'd be like if you were bleeding out of your finger and you painted your finger red.
Well, they put caulk.
A little.
Put caulk in your finger. I don't know.
Sure. Caulk and paint it red.
Right.
In January of 1919, a little over 3 years after the tank's construction, World War I was over, the Spanish flu pandemic was over, and the Red Sox had just won the World Series.
Big moment, big mood.
With the war being over, the demand for molasses had gone down significantly because they didn't need to make bombs anymore. And on top of that, Prohibition was starting, so they couldn't really use it to make that much rum either. On January 12, 1919, a steamship arrived at the North End docks and unloaded 600,000 gallons of molasses into the Purity Distilling Company's tank. The transfer of molasses took a little over a day since it was so thick and viscous, and it moved really slowly into the tank. But the molasses was warmed up a little bit to decrease its viscosity for transfer. With that delivery, they had brought the tank to just over 2 million gallons of molasses, which meant it was just shy of being at maximum capacity. A few days later, on Wednesday, January 15th, 1919, Boston experienced what is known as January thaw, or false spring. According to the Farmer's Almanac, it's weather which can last up to about a week, with temperatures rising an average of about 10 degrees Fahrenheit higher than the previous week before dropping back down to usual January temperatures. So it was about 40 degrees that day, and only a few days earlier it had been 2 degrees. For this January thaw, Bostonians really took advantage of the slightly nicer weather, leaving their windows open, doing their chores outside, doing whatever they could to feel that balmy 40 degrees.
Love it.
As a Michigander, you know that well.
Oh, I get it. People go out in shorts.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
Yeah. Boston gets cold too. I mean, they have crazy winters. Oh, yeah.
It's just as bad.
Yeah. 65-year-old Bridget Clowdy and her family lived across the street from the tank at the base of Copse Hill Terrace, and William White, who was superintendent of the Purity Distilling Company, had decided to leave early to enjoy a lunch and some shopping with his wife. And like I said, all the people around this tank who lived around the tank were like out and about doing their business because it was warm. A Boston police patrolman by the name of Frank McManus was walking his regular route down Commercial Street and was coincidentally making a routine call on the call box back to Boston police headquarters, right as he heard what he described later as a tremendous rumbling and grinding sound, which turned into what sounded like machine gun fire.
Really?
Like a really big, massive groan, and then just like machine gun. He turned around and saw this steel-plated tank was splitting apart, and what was making the machine gun sounds were the thousands of rivets that were shooting out from the tank as it broke. So it essentially was like a machine gun because the rivets were shooting out.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there's thousands of them.
Yes. So he sees this massive tank starting to break apart, and the contents of the tank began spraying out. The long rumble, some people believed, was the elevated train that was nearby the tank, while others reported a tremendous crashing and deep growling like a thunderclap. McManus had the presence of mind to make one of the most unbelievable calls back to the Boston police headquarters. He said, "Send all the rescue personnel immediately. There is a wave of molasses coming down Commercial Street." And the molasses was not moving slowly, as you might expect. The one thing about molasses is that there's that saying, you're as slow as molasses, because it's really thick and it moves really slowly. But this molasses was moving really quickly. At the outset, it was moving 35 miles an hour.
What?
With a wave of molasses being about 35 feet high.
It's a molasses tsunami.
Yes.
Wait, why is it moving so fast?
Because it was so pressurized as it was like coming out. Or I don't know if pressurized is the right word, but it broke out and then 2.5 million gallons of molasses starts spilling out. And also it was like slightly, it was warmer than it had been, and it was warmer inside the tank than it was outside.
Yeah, sure, but it's still not warm. It's 50 degrees in the tank maybe. So it was like 40 out. And even if it was not 40, you were saying it takes a whole day to transfer from one tank to another. 600 gallons.
So 600,000. I think the sheer volume of molasses was just making it come out really quickly. And also it was a big tank, so it was 35 feet high. I mean, the tank itself was 50 feet.
Yeah, no, but was it moving like a liquid, or was it kind of more solid and just like a ball, like a snowball?
No, it was moving like a liquid.
Okay.
Yeah. So after a little bit, that 35 foot high wave had leveled off to about 20 feet high and 160 feet wide. So it covered some ground.
Yeah.
The density of molasses is about 1.4 metric tons per cubic meter, or 12 pounds per U.S. gallon, if that means anything to you, 40% more dense than water, resulting in the molasses having a great deal of potential energy. The warmer weather greatly affected the flood, and the molasses would have been a few degrees warmer than it was outside the tank, like I said. The wave completely destroyed the north end of Boston waterfront. It destroyed buildings, carts, horses, people, anything in its path. Patrolman Frank McManus happened to be about 100 feet from the tank when it had given way, and he said, "I felt some wet, sticky substance strike me about the shoulders." He first thought it was mud, but that's when he saw the tank fall. He was able to escape the wave by running up a side street, which was when he called for backup. H.M. Dorley, a Boston Street Railway Company freight agent, heard the rumble and felt his building shake, and he immediately knew what it was. He cried, "The molasses tank is gone!" Just before the wave hit his office, trapping Dorley and his coworkers inside for hours as the molasses rushed past them. Dorley was quoted in the Boston Post saying, "The broken parts of the tank missed our shed by only a matter of inches. If it had struck it, well, I wouldn't be talking with you. Parts of the tank struck other houses and they crumpled like eggs. How we escaped, I'm at a loss to explain. A little short of a miracle."
Wow, barely got out.
Yeah. The wave was of sufficient force to drive steel panels of the burst tank against the grinders of the adjacent Boston Elevated Railway's Atlantic Avenue structure.
What does that even mean?
It tipped a streetcar momentarily off its tracks, and it was so strong that it bent the railroad and like derailed a train, which I'm going to talk about later. But
whoa.
Yeah, that's how much energy it had. It was able to like bend a railroad.
Yeah, well, if you think about starting a wave of water at this point.
Yeah, I mean
I'm assuming it's downhill, right?
Well, we just talked about the big dam that exploded in LA.
Yeah, right.
That big thing of water that completely ripped through the San Fernando Valley. And it destroyed train tracks and trains and cars and buildings. Like, it took apart everything. So that was essentially this, but just at a bit of a smaller scale.
I know. I'm like, it's not the size of a dam, but
no.
And what I'm trying to say is it's 40 times as heavy.
Right. No, it did damage for sure. Yeah. And it was really sticky and thick. And so anyone who got caught up in it was in bad shape.
Yeah. So you said that they were stuck in their building for hours.
Yeah.
I mean, the wave didn't move at hours. Did it just stick them in?
Very possibly. Or like
all the debris.
Yeah, debris. Exactly. Pinned them in. Stephen Puello described how nearby buildings were swept off their foundations and crushed. Several blocks were flooded to a depth of 2 to 3 feet. They said, quote, "Molasses waist deep covered the street and swirled and bubbled about the wreckage. Here and there struggled a form. Whether it was an animal or human being was impossible to tell. Only an upheaval, a thrashing about in the sticky mass, showed where any life was. Horses died like so many flies on sticky flypaper. The more they struggled, the deeper in the mess they were ensnared. Human beings, men and women, suffered likewise.
Poor horses.
Yeah, poor horses. Poor people, too.
I mean, but you know.
I get it.
We feel better about them. We feel worse for the animals.
What is that about people?
I don't know, man.
That it's like, I can handle hearing about a person dying, but as soon as the dog dies, it's over.
Yeah, it's the innocence, you know?
No, for sure.
We need a return of the vibes.
We need to return the vibes.
We need a return of the vibes. Molasses crushed the vibes. We need to return the vibes.
Molasses is unfortunately going to continue to crush the vibes.
How long does it go for?
A while.
I mean, doesn't it spread out eventually to the point where you just kind of get stuck knee deep and then you're like,
it was waist deep, but that was like when it stopped. So
yeah, like what happened? What made it stop moving? Did it eventually get spread thin enough that it just stopped?
Yeah, it emptied the tank.
Keep going? No, but did it just keep moving?
Not forever.
Forever? Yeah, no. When did it stop?
I don't know.
Answer questions. I don't want to do work. Figure it out.
Well, why don't I keep telling you the story? Okay. The molasses flood leveled homes, shipping docks, warehouses, and Engine 13 of Boston's fire department. In the nearby Engine 13 firehouse, firefighters Bill Connor, Fred McDermott, Nat Bowring, and Patty Driscoll were playing cards on their lunch while colleague George Leahy and John Barry watched. They had very little time to react as Bill Connor, who had been facing the window, saw this wall of molasses rushing toward the building and alerted everyone. Patty Driscoll was able to escape the building before the wave struck it, and it lifted Engine 13 Firehouse off of its foundation, sending it toward Boston Harbor and trapping the remaining men inside. When the wave slammed into the firehouse, the second floor collapsed directly on top of the first floor, like pancaked down, leaving four firefighters trapped underneath. One of them, George Leahy, spent 4 hours trying to keep his head above molasses, and he was literally drowning in it. By the time rescue workers had gotten to them, after fighting through the wreckage of the building, George Leahy had unfortunately died due to drowning in this thick liquid. The other men thankfully survived. Bridget Clowerty, who had been outside doing chores when the tank burst, said she felt a rumble and a sudden rush of air. Her house was completely swept up and carried across Commercial Street, and parts of it literally fell on top of her. Her son Martin, who was a well-known amateur boxer in the area, was asleep in their home when the wave struck the house. When he woke up, he was covered in debris and molasses. He was able to find and rescue his brother and sister, but he wasn't able to find his mother, and they later learned that she had died before rescue workers could get to her. Imagine waking up to debris and molasses on you, and your house is moving because it's off of its foundation, and it's in a wave of molasses.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't imagine how confusing that is.
Yeah.
You're like, fucking molasses?
It makes no sense.
It really doesn't, but I guess you have no time to really think about it. But
yeah, and I mean, he did what he could. Like, he immediately sprung into action and saved both of his siblings, and his mother just happened to be outside and was like crushed by the house because it was lifted off of its foundation. That is one of the craziest parts about this whole thing to me, is that this molasses was not only like fast enough and a big enough wave to wreck things, but it was strong enough to lift houses off of its foundation.
I mean, that's a force of nature.
It's not, though. It's molasses.
But it really, is akin to a hurricane or a tornado.
A tsunami. Yeah, it's not a natural disaster, but it is a disaster.
Yeah, it's almost worse.
Yeah. The wave was so strong that it bent the steel beams holding up the elevated train track, causing it to collapse, like I had mentioned. Albert Lehman, who was a brakeman for the elevated railway, saw the wave and from sheer luck managed to pass over the damaged section and come to a stop. So he successfully stopped the train, thankfully, but he still had to scramble onto the trestle and he raised his arms, frantically screaming, "Stop, the track is down." Thankfully, he was able to get the attention of the oncoming engineer who stopped the other train just in time. So they avoided multiple train
derailments
and like collisions.
Wow.
The Boston Globe reported that people were picked up by a rush of air and hurled many feet. Others had debris hurled at them from the rush of sweet-smelling air. A truck was picked up and hurled into the Boston Harbor. After the initial wave, the molasses became viscous, exacerbated by the cold temperatures, trapping those caught in the wave and making it even more difficult to rescue them. After the initial wave, rescue efforts sprang into action really quickly. The USS Nantucket, a training ship of the Massachusetts Nautical School, was docked nearby at the playground pier. Lieutenant Commander Howard G. Copeland had heard the rumble and seen the tank collapse, and he immediately issued a call to quarters, and 116 sailors from the USS Nantucket rushed to the rescue. So from the moment it exploded, there were people already starting to, like, rescue other people. It was a very quick response time, but it was just such a terrifying and horrible wave that it was still doing a lot of damage, regardless of the rescue effort.
Yeah, I mean, you can only do so much.
Right. The cadets ran several blocks toward the accident and entered into the knee-deep flood of molasses and fought through the rubble to pull out any survivors they could, while others worked to keep curious onlookers from getting in the way of the rescuers. Because also, like, think about that. Even if you're, like, out of the way of the wave, you're going to stand there and just gawk. I would. That's crazy. You see a wave of molasses that's plowing down buildings and throwing cars into the harbor. Yeah, I'm going to stand and stare.
Yeah, I'd just be dumbfounded.
Yeah. By the time police had arrived, the sailors had pulled more than 20 wounded people from the wreckage. Policemen, firemen, Red Cross workers, and civilians all rushed to help, but the effort was extremely difficult. Some nurses from the Red Cross dove into the molasses, while others tended to the injured, keeping them warm and feeding the exhausted workers. Many of these people worked through the night, and the injured were so numerous that doctors and surgeons set up a makeshift hospital in a nearby building. The Boston Globe applauded the women of the Red Cross, saying they came in a hurry with a wonderfully equipped ambulances, and they worked fearlessly and with remarkable efficiency. They plunged into the flood of molasses knee-deep and worked without regard for their personal comfort. A relief station was set up in Haymarket Square to receive the injured, and according to the Boston Globe, by 1 p.m., only a half an hour after the collapse, an estimated 100 to 150 people had been taken from the wreckage, with still so many others who needed help. 30 minutes after the thing collapsed, and already they have 100 and 150 people who are, like, injured and covered in molasses.
How many people were in the
flood zone?
Yeah, the flood zone. I was going to say the blast radius, but
I mean, it was a city.
Yeah.
They had a bunch of businesses, a bunch of neighborhoods, like a lot of people. Oh, this is gruesome. A Navy sailor on leave, Harry Howe, tried to help people in the molasses and later recalled, quote, "We saw this big cloud of brown dust and dirt and a slight noise, and there was an arm sticking out from underneath the wheel of a truck. So two of us got a hold of his arm and pulled, and unfortunately we pulled his arm off."
Oh.
Yeah.
Jesus.
I don't even know how you do that. Like, how much force?
Jesus.
Yeah. So
he's under a truck.
It's one of those things where, like, you think about a molasses flood and you're like, that's kind of silly. But then when you, like, hear the actual reality of the situation, it was incredibly grisly and, like, violent and devastating.
Yeah. I mean, you could think if it's just because it's sweet, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's sugar.
Just, yeah, but I mean, you think about anything else that was like liquid mercury, something that's super heavy.
Yeah, it would be scarier than molasses, you think? Oh, like, yeah. In theory, you know, you're like, you think just about it and you're theory. Like, oh, it just, that's scarier. But no, molasses is just as bad, if not worse, because it's way thicker than water. You know, like, think about a wave of water. That's still awful and scary, but a wave of molasses is almost scarier. Damn. Okay. So the molasses was so thick on everything and it was all covered. And it was extremely hard to spot survivors, or even if they did find someone, it was hard to identify people. They couldn't even tell if it was a man or a woman, who they were. Like, they couldn't ID people because they were so coated in this, like, thick, sticky brown liquid. It's like they're sludge people. It's crazy.
Yeah. They're like the ducks from the Dawn soap.
They needed Dawn. That's all they needed.
No.
Call the Dawn soap commercial people. Oh, we shouldn't have joked just then, because now we have really terrible injuries. The Boston...
The ripping of the arms was pretty bad. Does it get worse?
Well, I mean, it's just people were very, very injured. So the Boston Globe reported some of the people who had been caught in the debris were frightfully hurt. The injuries caused them to shriek at every move, and these shouts were not quieted when they were placed in the ambulances to be hurried to the hospitals. At those hospitals, nurses' spotless white uniforms were covered with blood and molasses. Horses had become trapped, and the rescue workers weren't able to save them, and they ended up having to kill the horses. Like, they just had to shoot the horses. Isn't that awful?
That's so terrible, but I guess it's better than just starving them. I don't know.
It's just awful. Yeah. There were 21 people killed after being crushed or drowned in molasses, and 150 injured. They suffered from broken backs, broken pelvises, fractured skulls.
Ew.
The wounded included people, horses, and dogs. Coughing fits became one of the most common ailments after the initial blast. And a man named Edward Parks wrote One Child's Experience in 1983 for an article for the Smithsonian. And he said, quote, Anthony DiStasio, walking homeward with his sister from Michelangelo School, was picked up by the wave and carried, tumbling on its crest, almost as though he were surfing. Then he grounded, and the molasses rolled him like a pebble as the wave diminished. He heard his mother call his name, and he couldn't answer. His throat was so clogged with the smothering goo. He passed out, then he opened his eyes to find three of his four sisters staring at him. Thankfully, he lived, but doesn't that sound like a true nightmare? Like, that sounds so terrifying.
So he swallowed a shit ton of molasses?
Yeah, he was, like, picked up on the wave, basically surfing, and then he was essentially, like, the wave crashed on top of him, and he was, like, tossed around like a little pebble, and then he was pulled out, I guess, by his sisters, and he opened his eyes to see them all staring at him.
Terrifying.
Covered in molasses. A child.
How old was he?
I don't know how old he was, but still. The vast majority of these people were Italian immigrants who were making deliveries to the North End waterfront at the time, or Irish city workers who were working at the North End paving yard. So it was a lot of, like, families and immigrants and, like I said, a couple businesses and the firehouse. The cleanup took weeks and over 87,000 man hours. Over 300 people volunteered. The lack of electrical equipment available at the time made the cleanup really difficult, and it took days before officials were able to assess the full extent of the damage and determine the death toll. They ended up using pressurized seawater from fire boats to wash the molasses residue away, and then they used sand to absorb the excess. Recovery efforts took just as long, and many of the dead weren't recovered until weeks later, or even months later. Other victims were swept into the Boston Harbor and were found 3 to 4 months after the disaster. Isn't that crazy?
Oh my God, that's so long.
I know. The fire department had to pump thousands of gallons of molasses from cellars, and the hardened remains needed to be physically removed with chisels, saws, and brooms. So I guess while it was, like, still in liquid form, it was able to be, like, pumped out kind of slowly. But then as it got colder and colder and it, like, hardened, they had to chisel it away and, like, sweep the chiseled pieces away.
Yeah, because at that point it's just crystallized.
Yeah, and it's on everything. 35 feet high.
What a nightmare.
Yeah. Rescue workers, cleanup crews, and sightseers had tracked molasses through the streets and spread it to the subway platforms, to the seats inside the trains and the streetcars, to payphone handles, into homes, and countless other places. It was reported that everything that a Bostonian touched was sticky. And the harbor was brown with molasses until summer. It was an extremely time-consuming and difficult task to clean up the city of Boston. And people, understandably, wanted answers about how this happened and what went wrong. And so an investigation was launched.
Yeah, well, I was wondering what this part of the story was going to be like, and if anyone got held accountable or was held liable. This is, I feel, a newer question that I keep running into with our stories is, if you're a company and you hire somebody to do something and they fuck up, is it your fault or theirs? You know, so I guess this one is more like they hired the wrong person.
So in this case, it's like more the company. Like, it was obviously a stupid person who, like, should have been more qualified. And, like, yeah, it's his fault for not doing any, like, checkups or safety measures or knowing how to read friggin' blueprints. Like, that's crazy to me. But the fact that the company hired him and, like, rushed the process because it had to be built in 2 months and then they got an early shipment so they couldn't have tested it safely. Like, yeah, it was, like, it seemed to be that guy's call on a certain things, but, like, the company hired him and it was the company's tank.
Right.
So, yeah. Several factors might have contributed to the disaster. The first factor is that the tank may have leaked from the very first day that it was filled in 1915. The tank was also constructed poorly and tested insufficiently, as we know, and carbon dioxide production may have raised the internal pressure due to fermentation in the tank. So, the molasses was coming out much harder and, like, faster because of this potential pressure. Warmer weather the previous day would have assisted in building this pressure as the air temperature rose from 2 to 41 degrees Fahrenheit over that period. The failure occurred from a manhole cover near the base of the tank and a fatigue crack that possibly grew to the point where it exploded. The tank had only been filled to capacity 8 times since it was built a few years previously, putting the walls under an intermittent cyclical load. It was also discovered during the investigation that the man who built the tank was not testing it properly. He didn't build it properly. He ignored the warning signs. So there was a lot that came out in this investigation, and also, like, people were pissed, and rightfully so.
Oh, yeah. How many people did this kill? Hundreds?
21. It killed 21.
21? There was 121?
Yeah. There was 150 injured, 21 killed.
I mean, still, I thought there was way more, but that's still...
A lot
of people.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just him. Other people were raising concerns and the company didn't do anything either.
A 2014 investigation applied modern engineering analysis and found that the steel was half as thick as it should have been for the tank of its size, even with the lower standards they had at the time. So even by 1919 standards, the steel was half as thick. Another issue was that the steel lacked manganese and was made more brittle as a result. I don't know what that is, but half as thick and it was more brittle.
I'm pretty sure it's another element. It was just another thing. Think of it like glue.
Great. It's the glue.
It's not, but it functions like it.
Okay, perfect. The tank's rivets were also apparently flawed and cracks first formed at the rivet holes. In 2016, a team of scientists and students at Harvard University conducted extensive studies of the disaster, gathering data from many sources, including 1919 newspaper articles, old maps, and weather reports. And the student researchers also studied the behavior of cold corn syrup flooding a scale model of the affected neighborhood. The researchers concluded that the reports of the high speed of the flood were credible. The warmer weather made it move faster, and then when the tank collapsed, the fluid cooled quickly as it spread until it reached Boston's winter evening temperatures, and the viscosity increased dramatically. The Harvard study concluded that the molasses cooled and thickened quickly as it rushed through the streets, hampering effects to free victims before they suffocated. A month later, Chief Judge of Boston Municipal Court Wilfred Bolster made the results public. There was evidence that the tank was wholly insufficient in point of structural strength to handle the load of molasses, and the USIA was held responsible and found guilty of manslaughter.
The company.
The company.
Wait, so this is actually really interesting. What happens to the company now?
They got to pay a lot of money.
Okay.
Yeah.
So no one goes to jail? Like, you can't put a company in jail.
No, yeah, I don't think any one person went to jail for this. I think it was just like the company got a slap on the wrist and they had to pay out a lot of money.
Yeah, I don't know. That's really interesting to me because they got convicted of a crime.
Yeah.
But they're not a person.
Yeah, it's very, very strange.
Was this civil claims court or was this actual criminal court?
I don't know which it was, but there was a big class action lawsuit that came out of this, but also they were found guilty of manslaughter. So I think it was a combination of a lot of things.
Okay.
121 different lawsuits involving victims of the accident were made into a class action lawsuit against Purity Distilling Company and its parent company. Door versus U.S. Industrial Alcohol was the largest class action suit to date in Massachusetts and one of the largest in the U.S. The investigation lasted 6 years and included testimony for more than 3,000 witnesses. Purity Distilling's defense blamed the disaster on Italian anarchists because some of the alcohol produced was being used to make bombs, and they were protesting big business.
They were blowing shit up.
Yeah, so this was backed up by the fact that anarchists had twice before targeted United Industrial Alcohol during World War I. So they're like, well, they targeted us again, and it's their fault. This defense could have worked if not for the appointment of Colonel Hugh W. Ogden as auditor to oversee the lawsuit. Ogden was known as a conservative businessman, and he famously despised the methods and motives of anarchists, but he also believed in being fair and justice. So on April 28, 1925, after years of testimony, Ogden released the special report on liability to the Superior Court, which rejected the USIA's claim of sabotage, and it concluded that the tank collapsed due to structural failure. He said the USIA needed to pay $300,000 in damages to the victims, the City of Boston, and the Boston Elevated Railway Company. The company ultimately paid out $628,000 in damages, which is about $11 million in 2023's, it adjusted for inflation standards. And relatives of those killed reportedly received around $7,000 per victim, which is equivalent to $123,000 in 2023.
I don't know. It doesn't sound like enough to me, but this is such a weird... deciding how much is such a weird question.
Yeah, there's never enough, but it's...
What do you do with that money?
I don't know. It takes time. You probably don't do anything for a long time.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And then even after that, I guess you just do what you think they would want you to do with it.
I guess. Yeah, I don't know.
Or it's, do something charitable. Yeah, I don't know.
It's an impossible conversation. Who knows?
Right.
It was one of the first class action lawsuits in Massachusetts, and it was considered a milestone in paving the way for modern corporate regulation. Massachusetts and other states responded to the verdict by passing laws to certify engineers and regulate construction. So thankfully something positive came out of this. It's one of those things where like something really terrible had to happen for positive change, but at least there was that. The molasses cases represented the beginning of the end of an era when big business faced no government restrictions on their activities and no consequences. United States Industrial Alcohol did not rebuild the tank. The property formerly occupied by the molasses tank and the North End Paving Company became a yard for the Boston Elevated Railway, and it is now the site of a city-owned recreational complex officially named Langone Park, featuring a Little League baseball field, a playground, and a bocce ball court.
Sounds nice.
Yeah. All that remains of the giant Boston molasses disaster is a small plaque at the entrance to a waterfront park in the North End that reads, "On January 15th, 1919, a molasses tank at 529 Commercial Street exploded under pressure, killing 21 people. A 40-foot wave of molasses buckled the elevated railroad tracks, crushed buildings, and inundated the neighborhood. Structural defects in the tank combined with unseasonably warm temperatures contributed to the disaster." Local legend has it that on particularly warm days, you can still smell the faint aroma of molasses seeping up from the streets on the North End.
Could you imagine if that's true?
It'd be weird as hell.
A century later, you can still tell.
Yeah, over a century.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine having everything be sticky.
Yeah, but not just sticky to the point where it's like a Jolly Rancher.
Like a fly on fly paper. Like you're stuck. Like, yeah. Sticky is an understatement. But I'm more so talking about the people who were in the cleanup crew, you know, like, or the who got out of the flood. Because like I said earlier, like people had it on every part of them. So like they walked away. It was on the bottoms of their shoes. They walked it down the street. They walked it into the subway. They sat on the chair. They got molasses in the buildings. They got it on the, like, literally everything. Molasses was essentially, like, Boston was coated in sugar for like months. Yeah. The entire city.
Even the ocean, you said, took months to not look brown.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because they were using the like salt water to pressure wash it away or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And then it ran into the water and it was just like sugar water.
Still.
Imagine also, I was thinking about this in the beginning, even just with the tank like still being a fully functioning tank and it's just like leaking bits of molasses. Could you imagine the bugs?
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
The
bugs, dude.
Oh, God. Like the kids licking the tank and it's just like got bugs in it, probably. Well, it's just
bugs and bacteria.
Ooh, they just paint it brown. They're like,
no.
It's probably lead paint. They're like licking the side of the tank.
Oh, God. You're probably like right, though.
Full of bugs and like lead paint. What could go wrong? The tank is groaning. It's like this massive tank and it's like,
it's live
every time it's filled.
Yeah, and everyone's just looking. Could you imagine just being the technician or whatever that fills it? You're just looking at each other.
Yeah, like, is this fine?
Okay, it does this?
Yeah, well, we could just get to fill this tank and then we get to peace out.
Right.
Back to wherever we're coming from.
It's like as soon as it's done, it's like, see ya.
Bye.
Goodbye. Not our problem.
Have fun with your molasses.
Wow.
Yeah. So on January 15th, 2019,
Now imagine being a fish, dude.
What? With all the molasses in the water?
Yeah.
They're just
hopped
up.
Did it kill all the fish?
They're like kids in a candy store. They're just so sugared up. They don't know what to do with themselves. They're swimming around so fast.
Yeah. It's like fish in a candy store. It's like exactly. Nemo's popping off.
Yeah.
But did it kill the fish or were they thriving? I
don't
know.
I didn't see any reports of the fish dying. I just saw that the water was brown for like months.
Yeah, they were probably more focused on the people.
Yeah, you know, it's like they're not probably really worried about the fish. They're like, oh, multiple people died and 150 are injured. So
true.
Yeah. On January 15th, 2019, for the 100th anniversary of the event, a ceremony was held in remembrance. Ground-penetrating radar was used to identify the exact location of the tank from 1919. The concrete slab base for the tank remains in place approximately 20 inches below the surface of the baseball diamond at Langone Park. I don't know if I'm saying that park name correctly. Sorry. Attendees of the ceremony stood in a circle marking the edge of the tank, and they read aloud the names of the 21 people who died in the flood that day. And that is the story of the Boston Molasses Flood. Or as I also saw it referred to as the Boston Molassacre.
Guys,
we love a cheeky phrase.
Was that in the paper?
Probably.
Oh, God.
I just saw it on an article. They were like also known as the Boston Molassacre. And I was like, sure, that's, yeah. I get it, but also, this is serious.
21 people died.
Yeah, like, this is crazy. Anyway.
I'm just imagining, I mean, whatever newspaper at the time, like, the editor's like,
oh, we did.
We're going to do it.
We really
right?
did a good one with this one.
This is funny.
Yeah.
I don't know any of these people. It's the Molassacre.
It'll sell papes.
I'm trying to make money here.
Will it sell the papes? It'll sell them.
It did. I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
Well, you were definitely right in saying that this is a weird one.
Yeah.
Because, again, on its face, you're like, oh, sweet, it's sugar.
Mm-hmm.
What could be so harm? Like, yeah, what could cause harm?
What's so scary about that? We could all make cookies.
Right.
You know? No, we can't. We're going to get smothered.
It's just a force of destruction. I can't really imagine
the fear.
Well, no, it's not just the fear, it's the shock, because you were saying that people would smell sweet and then they would just die.
Yeah, that's super strange. You'd be like, someone's baking something, and then you just get hit with molasses. Like,
oh,
what?
God.
Although you probably see it coming, because although 35 miles per hour is like pretty fast, it's also like slow enough that if you're standing far enough away, you could maybe get out of the way. Not like run 35 miles an hour, but like maybe go down a side street like the first guy did.
Yeah, I mean, it's as fast as a car on a residential street, but you know,
yeah,
step up
a side street. Yeah,
but yeah, I guess, you know, if you're far enough away, you could definitely get out of the way. But
just thinking about like the sheer size of like a 35 foot wave of molasses that was stretched out like 160 feet.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. But you said it was cresting like a wave.
Yeah.
Too.
Yes. Yeah. It was like picking people up like they were surfing.
Oh my God.
I know.
Well, that's what happened with the dam too. Some people just rode it.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, people rode that dam break wave on mattresses. Not because they were like, oh, I'm going to surf this wave, but because they were sleeping and then their mattress got picked up and they were sent like towns over or like into the ocean. There was a family who was sent into the ocean on a mattress. So yeah, like that, but molasses. It's just weird.
Weird and horrible.
But an interesting story nonetheless. I'm glad something came out of it. I'm glad they were like, hey, you know what? We should probably regulate the construction of things.
Yeah, well, they did so many things. They had the class action lawsuit. Mm-hmm. They paid people out.
Yeah.
They convicted the company. Right. And then they stopped and thought, hey, this is pervasive. Let's regulate, number one, the engineer's certification.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, let's regulate
Let's have like
big
permits.
Business.
Yeah.
Yeah, permits right. and stuff. So it actually sounds like they had a pretty comprehensive solution.
Yeah.
Which I think is rare.
Yeah, a lot of the time things are, like you said, they just put a Band-Aid over it.
Yeah. But, or maybe we're overselling it. I don't know.
Ah, who knows? But
it did something.
That's the story. I think that's enough said about that. Right,
yeah.
Palate
cleanser.
Yeah, let's have a palate cleanser before we sign out. What is your good thing? If you don't have one, I can go first.
You go first.
My good thing is that we just cooked dinner with my grandparents. They live across the street from my childhood home. And we went across the street and we cooked burgers with them. We listened to Italian cooking music and we had some wine. And it was really fun. And it was really good.
Yeah, they loved it. So I'm glad they enjoyed salmon burgers from Costco.
Classic.
You know, it's Costco. My favorite.
Yeah.
So.
We also had a honeydew for dessert. The perfect ripeness. Just a lovely summer melon.
I know.
You can't go wrong with some burgers and melon in the summertime. Like, come on. Nothing better.
Nothing better.
In New York?
No,
nothing better.
I mean, come on.
Come on.
No, number one, I haven't had fruit as dessert in, well, not your house, but with your family. I don't think ever.
Okay. Well, we're a very like sweets household.
Right.
We have like cookies and cakes and pies.
Whenever I come over, y'all are always stocked up.
Yeah.
Cakes,
we
pies,
stay, we
cookies.
Stay ready.
It's everything.
Well, we're a hosting household. We stay ready.
I know.
Yeah.
But you know that it's over the top. It's like
we're
you
Italians
have,
in New York.
I know.
What are we gonna do? Not feed you?
No, but stop, because you know it's a notch above that.
Yeah. Right.
It's like there'll be like three pies left over at the end of the weekend.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how are we gonna finish this?
Well, how about you just mind your business and enjoy the pie?
But you know what? I'm thankful. I'm never hungry when I'm here. I'll
and
tell
that's
you that.
The truth. I'll tell you what.
And the other thing is, I will start doing your accent because it's fun.
It's addictive.
And I really hope, yeah, it's addictive. And I really hope I'm not offending because
no, you're not.
I will just do it.
No, it's I love when you do it. I love when anyone does it.
Mm-hmm.
That's my good thing. What's your good thing?
My good thing is that we got to use your friend's hot tub.
Oh, don't get me started.
And it was lovely.
Yeah.
We had a great night. And I guess generally I'm excited for the week.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of stuff planned. We're going to hang out with a lot of your friends.
Yeah. When this comes out, it'll be after 4th of July, but we're going to be having some 4th of July festivities with some friends from home. What's better than that?
Nothing better.
Just keep going back to nothing better.
Nothing better than a melon. In the summer with
friends from home.
4th of July.
And a hot tub.
And a hot tub. And let's end on that.
Yeah, and that's our good things. Well, thank you so much for listening. If you would like to head over to Patreon and hear the bonus episode that came out this week, head over there. There's a bunch also in the backlog you'll get access to. That's patreon.com/nottodaypodcast. If you or anyone you know has a story of survival or something crazy that's happened to you and you'd like to share it with us and possibly hear it on an upcoming listeners episode, send it to notodaypodcast@gmail.com. We have a TikTok that is not today podcast and a Twitter that is not today podcast, but the T on the podcast is a 3.
Because that makes sense.
And just keep breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah.